Greetings, and welcome to the IOMSN Town Hall Discussions, Resources for the MS Nurse Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A question-and-answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to introduce your host, Lori Mayer. Thank you, Ms. Mayer. You may begin.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Lori Mayer, and I'm Director of Medical Research for the MS Clinic in Central Texas. And on behalf of the IOMSN and as co-chair for this program, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's town hall discussion entitled Resources for the MS Nurse. These educational sessions will be held by telephone on the third Tuesday of each month. This is our third one this year. And each discussion will be led by an IOMSN member speaking on a selected topic for about 15 minutes, which will then be followed by open discussion, and that will be limited to about an hour. We would like to acknowledge and show our appreciation to Biogen IDEC for supporting this project through an unrestricted educational grant. Thank you, Biogen IDEC. So we begin our discussion this evening with Brant Oliver. Brant is a nurse practitioner in neurology and psychiatry at the MS Clinic MS Center at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire. He's an MS certified nurse with a master's in public health and is currently a PhD candidate. Tonight, Brant's discussion is going to be focusing on the psychosocial resources available for the MS nurse. Please join me in welcoming Brant for this evening's meeting. Brant?
Thank you very much, Lori, and welcome everyone to tonight's conference. It's a great honor to be asked to talk with you all this evening about a subject that I've been intimately involved with over my 8-year career in multiple sclerosis as a nurse practitioner. In my particular setting, I work as a evaluative sciences researcher and also as a psychiatric and mental health specialist within the MS Center at Dartmouth. In my role, I've become acutely aware of the importance of psychosocial issues in multiple sclerosis. These are often issues that can go unseen or undetected unless a patient reports them to us directly. And sometimes in our attempts to focus on immunotherapy treatment and treatment of relapses and all the other important stuff in multiple sclerosis, sometimes these issues can be overlooked. Tonight I'm going to try and give you some resources that are free to access, easy to employ, and practical to use that you might consider incorporating into your practices. Before I start into that, just want to bring your attention to one website address. It's www.iomsn.org. You're probably all familiar with the site already. This is the International Organization of MS Nurses, or IOMSN, website. We have posted a detailed list of resources for the MS nurse on that website that will give you one-click access to things like continuing education programs, fellowships and mentorships, and a number of educational monographs and opportunities for furthering your professional education in multiple sclerosis. That list also includes links to the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers, CMSC website, the National MS Society website, the Multiple Sclerosis Association of America, the Multiple Sclerosis Association of America, U.S. clinical trials listings, and a series called Conversations in Multiple Sclerosis Nursing. So I would definitely encourage everyone to check out the IOMSN website and that list of resources. In addition, we would also recommend that you consult the websites offered by the various drug companies that provide immunotherapy treatments. Each one has a patient support program, and you can access those simply by Googling the name of the immunotherapy treatment for the company you're interested in accessing. I'm going to shift now to the psychosocial issues component. I'm going to talk about five components of psychosocial issues. This is not an exhaustive list, but I've picked this list for a couple of reasons. The things I'll talk about tonight are commonly occurring and have a significant impact both on psychosocial aspects, but also in some cases on MS immunotherapy treatment adherence and treatment course for the patient. These issues were also selected because there were freely available screens for them that you can download by Googling them or are otherwise available in the public domain without cost. So the five issues I'm going to cover are depression, cognition, fatigue, sexuality and intimacy, and social support. Now, given that probably all of you are working in multiple sclerosis settings, either in research or in a case management role or in a direct clinical role, my citing these issues probably doesn't strike you as anything new. These are very common issues. Up to 50% of patients with MS will experience depression in their lifetime. Between 50 and 65% will experience cognitive problems. Estimates on fatigue in MS range in the high 80s to low 90% in terms of prevalence, and fatigue is often the most commonly cited disabling feature of multiple sclerosis. Social support is frequently decreased in patients with multiple sclerosis, especially if they're facing issues at work or in their marriages. And intimacy is a common problem in many chronic diseases, including multiple sclerosis. And unfortunately, it's something that's not frequently asked about. Given the importance of these issues and the fast-paced nature of multiple sclerosis care in many places, a screening approach often makes sense. I'm going to discuss a number of screening instruments that are freely available, quick to do, and easy to interpret that you could consider using in your practice to identify some of these issues. Beginning with depression, I recommend a scale called the Center for Epidemiologic Studies Depression Scale. It's CESD for short. It's a 21-item inventory that's been validated in multiple sclerosis. It's freely available. It takes about 4 minutes to score. And scores of 16 or higher on this scale indicate a high likelihood of depression. For fatigue, I recommend a scale that is found in the Multiple Sclerosis Quality of Life Inventory called the MSQLI. This is a compendium of instruments that was developed by the National MS Society in the late 90s to measure quality of life. A number of the instruments I'll talk about tonight come from the MSQLI. The Modified Fatigue Impact Score is one of them. It's a short 5-item survey. You can do it in under a minute, and it gives you a scale of 0 to 20, and scores higher than 10 suggest significant impact to fatigue on a patient's life. The upside to using something like the Fatigue Impact Scale beyond initial screening is that as you monitor a patient's response to treatments like Provigil or amantadine or other agents that might be used for fatigue management or even behavioral approaches to improve fatigue, you would be able to monitor whether those fatigue impact scores decrease over time to gauge effectiveness of treatment. For sexuality and intimacy, there is another short-form survey that's part of the MSQLI called the Sexual Satisfaction Scale, and it's about 12 items and yields a numeric score that can show a degree of impact of multiple sclerosis on sexuality and intimacy. And scores ranging higher on this scale may suggest referring to a counselor or a social worker for further discussion of that sensitive issue. For cognition, I recommend the Multiple Sclerosis Neuropsychological Questionnaire. It's a 21-item survey that can be completed in less than 3 minutes. Scores higher than 21 suggest significant cognitive impairment. The importance of this particular scale, in addition to identifying cognitive problems, is that, you can quantify the effects of, say, cognitive rehabilitation therapies to see if the scores go down over time. And you can also judge whether it's an appropriate time to order the expensive full battery of neuropsychological tests on a patient. In many cases, it's a very high-cost test to do, and many patients have a hard time affording it. This particular screen can help you to determine whether it's an appropriate time to suggest referral for neuropsych testing or not. The next scale I recommend, again, comes from the Multiple Sclerosis Quality of Life Inventory. It's called the Modified Social Support Survey. This is, again, a brief scale that measures the degree of perceived support a patient has. This can be from a loved one, friends, colleagues at work, environmental supports, etc. Lower scores on this suggests that a patient is less supported and may need intensified nursing supports from a multiple sclerosis center. And this could impact things like treatment adherence or referrals. Patients with lower social support are less likely to utilize referrals, for example. And the final scale is a six-item quick-to-do scale called the Stanford Self-Efficacy Scale. It takes less than a minute to do. Self-efficacy is related to a number of things, including depression, immunotherapy, treatment adherence, and coping ability. Lower scores on self-efficacy, again, suggest that intensified nursing supports may be required for particular patients. If you put these scales together, they can be very helpful in predicting what services a patient may need from a psychosocial perspective. It can help you track the effectiveness of nursing and medical treatment interventions in certain cases, and can help you perhaps more efficiently align your clinical services to patients who need more intensive services, and perhaps help you avoid overutilization of services for other patients that may not need them. If you were to put all of these measures into a single battery, they would take about 15 to 20 minutes tops to administer. In some practices, that takes too long to do. It's possible to administer these at separate times. For example, in my practice, we'll administer just a couple of these each time the patient comes in, and we'll track them in a database over time, making sure that each patient gets all of these measures within an annual time period. So in brief, that was a very quick overview of a number of measures for detecting psychosocial issues that you can use. I've reviewed five issues: depression, fatigue, cognition, social support, and sexuality and intimacy. This is not an exhaustive list. There's certainly more psychosocial issues out there than this, but for tonight's discussion, we chose to focus on those five. And this discussion has only been about screening, not necessarily about diagnosis or what to do after these psychosocial issues have been identified. Perhaps in our discussion later on in the program, we'll be able to talk about what to do when we get some of these positive screening scores and what referrals might be appropriate, and perhaps hear from of the participants in the program what they do in their settings to deal with some of these issues, and hopefully we can share amongst ourselves some of the clinical pearls that we've gathered in these areas. Laurie, how are we doing on time?
I think we're doing really well on time, Brant. Thank you so much. That was very interesting, very informative. I did want to mention that, and just reiterating what Brant had said earlier, if you go to the IOMSN website, which is www.iomsn.org, and on that opening page you scroll down to the What's New section, you will see a paragraph that's on Town Hall Discussions, and in that paragraph is a link to Brant's list of resources. And so what I did is I downloaded it and put it on my desktop so that I can open it up. I have really easy access to it, and it has all the websites, the resources inside, and just click to it. I do have one question for you, Brant. You had said these questionnaires are for public domain.
Yes.
They're on the public domain, so that anybody can Google them and they'd find them and download them, correct?
Correct, and that's a good question, because it also means that you're not going to be charged for using them. For example, there are a number of scales that are proprietary, meaning that you need to get permission from the developer or the company that owns the instrument, and those can be very costly to use. The instruments I chose for tonight's discussion are all free, so you could download them tonight and use them tomorrow.
Okay, that's great. Do you think that using these screening resources would help with authorizations for medications or devices?
I think in certain cases it certainly would. For example, from my own practice, I've often used a combination of the CESD and the Modified Fatigue Impact Scale to try and get certain medications authorized for treatment of fatigue or for patients who suffer a combination of fatigue and depression. In other cases, I've used the MSNQ to argue for financial support for neuropsych testing.
Okay, great point. Doug, I think we're going to have the operator open the queue for our discussion. Doug, would you open up the floor for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you'd like to ask a question, it is star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star key. One moment while we poll for questions. Our first question comes from the line of June Halper from Fairlawn, New Jersey. Please proceed with your question.
Hi,
hey,
June.
Guys. Hi,
hello,
Grant.
June.
What a great talk.
Absolutely. Oh, thank you.
Absolutely fantastic. I have a quick question, and Lori, terrific. Don't forget to mention the survey at the end. Grant, do you ever see any of this type of survey material becoming an app, you know, where a patient can, you know, keep track of their own, you know, depression or fatigue or whatever, and then come in and show it to us, you know, because that's got to be the coming generation. But do you see some of this stuff transferring over to an app format eventually? Or
I would personally love to see that, and I think it would be coming. I know at our center we're starting to have, as part of something hospital-wide, they're having these website oriented questionnaires that patients can fill out before the visit, and that data feeds forward to the clinician before the patient comes in. So some of that's already happening. Unfortunately, not all of these instruments that I measured tonight are on those surveys, but it certainly would be nice to see an application with something like this become available and become a self-monitoring tool for patients.
Yeah, it almost could be like a bar graph where they could monitor their own fatigue and see what they're doing. I mean, it just seems that the next generation of this type of resource material should lend itself to the new technology. But anyway, congratulations. It was a fantastic, great, great program. I don't know what we're going to do after you for next month.
I'm sure you'll think of something.
Yes, thanks a lot. Okay.
Thank you, June.
Oh, you're welcome.
And I'll just add one additional point to June's point, because it's an important one, especially in mental health, and I think this also applies in general medical care. In many cases, simply adding self-monitoring can improve outcomes. For example, in depression treatment, starting a self-monitoring program can lend to reductions in symptoms of up to 10% within the first month just by doing monitoring. This often works in migraine headache as well. So say, for example, an application were developed for self-monitoring of some of these measures and a patient were to start using that, it could have a therapeutic as well as a monitoring effect.
I think that's a great idea, and I'm not sure how we could go about doing that, but that to be able to have the access it and have the patient self-monitor, I think that's a great idea. Okay, Doug, could you check the queue for other questions?
Certainly. Our next question comes from the line of Elizabeth Hudson from Chicago, Illinois. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Elizabeth. How are you tonight?
I'm good. How are you, Brant? Thanks so much for that presentation. I wanted to ask you, I somehow kind of missed what you had said about the scale you're using for cognition. Could you give me the name of that again?
Sure. It's called the Multiple Sclerosis Neuropsychological Questionnaire, MSNQ. And since you've asked the question, I'll provide a few more details on it. The cutoff score is 21. So scores higher than 21 suggest significant cognitive symptoms and something you may want to consider doing neuropsych testing to further delineate. There is one weakness to the MSNQ. It's sensitive to depression, so which is a good reason to screen for depression at the same time. If you have depression, the score on the MSNQ can skew upwards, so you could get a false positive on the MSNQ.
And where would I get that, a copy of that?
Just Google it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure.
Brant, I do have a question. Yeah. How will we interpret the scale? How will we interpret the information that we receive from these questionnaires?
It's a good question. For most of them, actually all of them, have scoring instructions when you download them, especially the ones in the MSQLI, the social support survey, the sexual satisfaction scale, the fatigue impact scale, and also a global mental health inventory are all collected in that MSQLI quality of life instrument. There's a detailed scoring manual in the back of that document. For the CESD, it's simply a sum of the item scores. So it's a numeric scale response for each question, and you sum up the responses and tabulate your score and then see if it's above the cutoff score or not. For the CESD, the cutoff score is 16. For the MSNQ, the cutoff score is 21. For the scales in the MSQLI, there isn't a cutoff score, but any score that's above 50% of the maximum score would be a cause for further clinical evaluation. And as a second follow-up to your question, it's important to note that these are screening scales. They're not diagnostic scales. So, for example, if I have a positive result on the CESD, it means I'm highly likely to have depression, but not necessarily. A trained clinician should do an evaluation to confirm the diagnosis.
Okay. Let's go on to the next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Jennifer Schmarka. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
Hi, Brant. This is Jen Schmurka. No, I just want to say that I think your explanation discussion has been extremely helpful. I wish that you would come and work with me down in Florida because I certainly could utilize you. But wanted to ask you, have you had any luck utilizing these tools? Say, for instance, if you're trying to get modafinil for a patient and having, because it's off-label use that we use it for, have you had any success utilizing any of these screening tools to help maybe with an authorization?
Yeah, the approach I've used is using the literature support from the few studies that are available showing that modafinil does have effect for fatigue and MS, and I'll pair that with a couple of screening scores. Say, for example, I tried amantadine first and that was ineffective. I might state that I've been tracking fatigue impact scale scores for the past 6 months on the patient and that they have not responded to the first treatment, and also document that the depression score is negative. Sometimes when you try for a fatigue medicine approval, the reviewer will come back to you saying, well, it's probably that because it's not fatigue, it's depression. So having that depression scale score can certainly bolster your argument that, you know, we're pretty sure it's fatigue here and not depression. When I've used the fatigue impact scale score, the Center for Epidemiologic Studies depression scale score, in conjunction with adding the article support showing that modafinil is effective, I haven't been denied on a modafinil claim.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Okay, Doug, I think we can move on to the next question. Thanks, Dan.
Our next question comes on the line of Tony Saldana King from Houston, Texas. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
Hey, Brant. Good. You did an awesome job.
Thank you.
I just wanted to also mention, Jennifer, it's funny, had asked about the provigil / new vigil. You can also probably do the Epworth scale. EPWORTH.
Yeah. Can you explain what the Epworth screens for? That's a very good point. And it's actually a scale we use in our clinic. But go ahead and explain to the audience.
I hope I do a good job. I mean, it's definitely kind of, instead of getting a sleep study, which is kind of expensive, the Epworth helps talk about excessive daytime sleepiness, or which is part of an indication. Brant, I might not do it justice because I don't know the whole scale myself.
Oh, you're on track so far. Keep going.
But I just wanted to suggest that certainly having that is supporting, and probably along with your fatigue scale, because that just supports the excessive daytime sleepiness. And I don't know the numbers that would qualify you, but certainly that's been helpful in getting our approval as well, and also having the support letter from the MS Society, and there was one for the Provigil too. And while you're throwing those things out there, pseudobulbar.
Oh, could I comment on the Epworth first before you go
to
the next part? Because the pseudobulbar is important to note, too. The Epworth, in my view, is a double-edged sword. It is very sensitive to daytime sleepiness. However, it's not specific to MS fatigue. It is specific for obstructive sleep apnea. So if you get a score of 11 or above on the Epworth, you would want to consider a sleep medicine referral for checking out sleep apnea. The upside is it's great if you get a positive screen and you diagnose the sleep apnea and treat it, because then it will have secondary effects on depression and fatigue and cognition and blood pressure and a number of other things. And there's a fair percentage of patients with MS that have sleep apnea or other sleep disorders. The negative is that if you have a positive Epworth, it could actually challenge your application for Provigil. Because the reviewer could, it depends how well they know the Epworth, but if you report a positive Epworth score, they could send it back to you and say, well, this patient is probably sleepy because they have sleep apnea, and they might deny the Provigil on that, on those grounds. So the Epworth's a double-edged sword. We use it, but for a different reason.
Okay. And just also the pseudobulbars, I don't know if the company, Nudexa or Avenir is the name of the company, if they have rights, but they do have tear-offs. And one of the reps actually shared with me that out of about 5,000 patients, they sent out a survey with the MSAA, and they got back, I think this is some surprising numbers, about almost half of the patients showed that the pseudobulbar effect. So, and I, like I said, I don't know if that's free or if it's, I mean, the company does have a tear-off that you could probably include, and I'm sure they'd be more than happy to share with you since it's a new medication.
So this was, just so I can understand better, this was a survey that the company sent out to patients, and they got a response. Out of the responses, they got 50% met criteria for pseudobulbar?
Exactly.
Interesting.
So, yes. And, so I just thought I'd kind of share that. But if you'd like, I can either scan and email that to you if you don't have that, or I can send it to Lori, and she can share with the IOMSN for the website.
Yeah, I'd encourage that. You know, my initial response is to be a little skeptical about that high rate of pseudobulbar. From what we know of the natural history data, it's the prevalence is much lower than that. It makes me wonder if a little more about that instrument and whether it's sensitive or specific enough. I'd love to take a look at it, though.
Well, sure.
Because if it is valid and sensitive, it might be another one to add to our list here.
Right. And, I mean, since you were throwing out forms, I thought those were two good ones that might be helpful.
Definitely.
Now, Tony, those are wonderful. Thanks for your input. I do have one question. The Epworth scale, is that public domain?
I believe it is.
It is also.
Yep.
Okay.
You could probably see the trend of in our use of screens at our center. Like most centers, we have tight budgets, so we've tried to find screens that are freely available and are validated in MS. Now, the Epworth is not validated in MS. That's one weakness of the Epworth.
Okay.
However, neither is the Stanford Self-Efficacy Scale, but it's still a recommended scale because it's been validated in so many other chronic illnesses. And sometimes you got to use the best that you can get your hands on. If you do have money available for screening, the multiple sclerosis self-efficacy scale is a better scale than the Stanford because it's been validated in MS, but you have to buy a site license to use it.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
And where would you do that? Would you go on the National MS Society? Is that from them?
It's not from them. It's actually through the investigator that developed the instrument. It's mostly used for research.
Okay. All right.
Thanks,
well,
Brent.
Great information, Grant. This is what we really need, are, you know, the psychosocial resources, and you've kind of explained all of it and given us some websites to go to and information. So let's go ahead and move on to another question in the queue.
Great.
Our next question comes from the line of Gina Remington from Dallas, Texas. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Gina. How are you tonight?
I'm doing wonderful. I appreciate the topic. I think it's a lot of information that we can all share from our experience.
Great.
I have two questions, though. One is I'm familiar with some of the screening tools that you've mentioned,
yep,
but not all of them.
Sure.
And I was wondering, are any of them available from the perspective of the caregiver or the spouse? That's my first question. And then the second one is, are any of them or all of them available in other languages other than English? Could those be also added to the website as a reference?
Wow, two good questions, and I only know the answer to one of them. The first one is, I am not aware of these instruments being available from the perspective of the caregiver, with the exception of the MSNQ. There is a a caregiver or a significant other version of that, or a, I think they call it a reporter version of the MSNQ. That can be taken from the perspective of someone's caregiver. But the other ones, unfortunately, are not available from the caregiver perspective. As far as being translated to different languages, I'm not aware of any of them being available in other languages, but I have not had to seek that. In my geographic area, we have mostly a Caucasian and English-speaking population, so I haven't had to search those things out in my area. I don't know if they have been translated.
Those are both great questions, Gina. And what we could do is actually throw the question out there, you know, into our listening audience and see if anybody knows if these questionnaires do come in different languages. I would think that
that's a great idea. Let's see if anybody knows.
Doug, did you want to check the next question?
Certainly. Our next question is a follow-up question from Jennifer Smirka. Please proceed with your question.
Hello again.
Hi, Brandon, Lori. So sorry, I feel like I have bad timing because I don't have an answer for either of your questions that were just posed, but they were great questions, Gina, and I'd like to say that if we find them, absolutely, we can ask Lenny to post them because I think they're valid, extremely important resources for our Spanish-speaking MS patients and their family members. One follow-up question to you, Brant, and just curious, in your clinical practice, do you, you know, you said the whole battery, if you wanted to give the entire battery, it would take 15 to 20 minutes. Is that something you would consider doing, say, for a new patient, just to establish a baseline and then kind of use each of the screening tools thereafter as needed? Or I'm just curious, could you speak to your practice regarding all of these tools?
Sure. The only instrument I'm usually a little hesitant to apply up front is a sexual satisfaction scale, only because the patient hasn't even met me yet or established rapport, so I may hold off on that one. Oftentimes what I do is I'll meet the patient first and have them complete it after the first visit, so at least I have a chance to establish some rapport first and explain why I'm using these scales. But that being said, I do try and get these measures at the very first visit, if at all possible. And then if I target certain areas, it's very rare that a patient has findings in all five of the areas. Sometimes it happens, but sometimes it's one, two, or three, and I can focus on those things over time. So as the patient continues to come back, they don't have to redo all of the measures every single time they come in. I would just measure the ones that I had identified issues with over time.
Thank you. And then just one quick follow-up to that is, when you do complete these, I know you're in research and heavily involved. Is that something that maybe you go back and you could retrospectively do case studies or kind of retrospective, you know, case reviews and something?
Oh, sure.
I'm just trying to think of ideas for generating nursing research.
Oh, absolutely. The answer to that is a big yes. We have a database program at our center, and I think some other centers, especially the academic ones, have databases also, which can be used for clinical use for feed-forward data, meaning that you've got the data to check before you see the patient, and you can see the patient's clinical trend over time. But you can also use it for research. Say you've accumulated 2 years of these scores for a population of patients, and you want to see on a population level how well your center is doing in managing, say, fatigue or depression. You could do exactly what you suggested, do a retrospective cohort study.
Yeah, I
great
think
idea.
That's, yeah, amazing. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Great idea.
Lori, if it's okay, I'd like to respond to a previous question that I didn't have an answer for while we were talking.
Sure.
I'm at my office, and I was wanted to provide some help to the person asking about caregivers.
Sure.
There is a very nice publication that's put out by the Family Caregiver Alliance, the National Center on Caregivers Caregiving, called Caregivers Count 2, a toolkit to help practitioners assess the needs of family caregivers. And on page, in Appendix I, there is a caregiver assessment. And in that assessment, there is a little scale called Functional Level of the Care Receiver. So this gets at the question which person had posed earlier about having instruments available by which the caregiver could evaluate the patient. So in this caregiver guide, there are a couple of those instruments available.
Brant?
Yes?
I do have a question. Thank you for that information.
Sure.
I believe Gina had asked about the caregivers. Can you tell me that, I guess what we could do right now is kind of throw that question back out to the audience again, as far as knowing whether any of these questionnaires possibly can be available in different languages.
That's a good idea. Let's see what if we get any feedback.
Let's see what
on
we
that.
Can get on that.
Right now we have one in queue. Our first comes from Tony Saldana King.
Okay.
Please proceed with your question.
Hello.
Hi, Tony. Hey, guys. Hi, Brand again. Sorry, my son's trying to, like, pull on me. I just wanted to let you guys know that we probably have the Spanish version because we have, you know, so many Hispanics at our center and in Houston. So we probably have access to a Spanish version because we've either had to convert it for research. So I can check with our research coordinator. And I just want...
It could be shared, maybe.
If it's possible to be shared, that would be fabulous.
I'm sure that Dr. Hutton and Dr. Rivera would not mind at all. And so I will check with Dr. Rivera tomorrow morning and find out. And I just wanted to say that thank you for the town hall discussions, because some of our nurses that do injection training out in the field have really benefited from this because they're so drug specific. So comments have been made that this has been very helpful.
That's great.
And so I just wanted to share that with you guys.
Thank you for the feedback.
Sure. Thanks.
Brant?
Yes.
Brant, this might be a good time for you to go over some of those other recommended general nursing resources that you just kind of touched on a little bit, because we certainly have enough time here.
Okay. Sure. And, Lori, if you could, if we get more questions on the line while I'm doing this, feel free to jump in and interrupt me.
Okay, I will.
I guess I'll start with the IOMSN resources. Simply because that was the initial website I referred people towards. It's a great place to start for a number of reasons. You can do everything from get continuing education to pursue scholarships to attend the annual CMSC consortium meetings. You can find out information on how to get certified as a multiple sclerosis certified nurse, pursue fellowships and mentorship for additional clinical and academic training. I'll give a few examples. For education and professional development, there's an excellent regional MS nursing education series ramping up for this year, and there's a direct link to that on that information sheet we've posted on the website. And these are on-site programs conducted around the country that are a full day and will cover quite a bit on multiple sclerosis given by expert speakers from around the country that are affiliated with the IOMSN. Highly recommend that you check those out. There are a number of practice monographs on different issues in multiple sclerosis nursing. There are online continuing education programs. There's a great new program on pregnancy and multiple sclerosis that has just been posted on the website. There are online patient education resources, things you can use to educate your patients. Many of you may be familiar with the Counseling Points publication that may arrive by mail to you at home or at your center that focuses on ways in which you can more effectively counsel your patients on difficult issues in multiple sclerosis. There are also approved speakers listings. So say that your multiple sclerosis organization or your center would like a MS nursing expert to come out and speak on a particular issue. There is a list of approved speakers in the IOMSN that you could contact or request come out to work with you in your area. There's also a publication called the IOMSN Update, MS Exchange, which is a great sort of current events and hot topics, issues, publication that many of you may receive already. So I'd recommend that you check that out as well. It looks like we still have more time to go on, so I'll go on to the resources that are available through the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers website. To get to that website, it's just www.mscare.org. A few things that I'd like to point out on this particular website. If you're interested in going to the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers annual meeting, which is going to be in Montreal, Canada this year, this summer, it should be an excellent meeting. I would highly recommend that you go. When I first entered the multiple sclerosis field, this was one of my first contacts with professional development in multiple sclerosis. It's a three-day conference jam-packed with topics ranging from disease management, nursing management, interprofessional management, psychosocial issues, you name it, it's pretty much there. The only thing that isn't there is probably bench science, although we do have some, I think there are some discussions of neuroimmunology included in this year's program. So it's quite diverse, and you can rack up a ton of continuing education credits while going there. And it gives you a really nice foundation in multiple sclerosis just by going to that conference one time. There are scholarships available to attend that conference. And also, the International Journal of Multiple Sclerosis Care has resulted from efforts by the IOMSN and the CMSC, and is now an index journal in the CINAHL database, the Database for Allied Health and Nursing Literature, and is soon, we're hoping, to be indexed on PubMed as well. And in that journal, it's a multidisciplinary journal on multiple sclerosis care, and I know that I receive it through being a member of IOMSN. And it's a great journal to follow on multiple sclerosis.
Grant, I do want to add that all the websites that you were just talking about, you have them all listed on the resource sheet that is on the website.
Yep, that's a good point. For many who are technologically impaired, such as myself, it's great to have a one-click resource so that instead of having to click through 10 things to find something, you know, just show me the button to push so I can find it. We've organized our information sheet that way, so you can just go to it and click in one click to get to where you want to go.
Now, Brant, when you look at the MSAA and the National MS Society, what do you feel are the best resources on there for psychosocial issues for patients?
Well, I guess I'll start first with the MSAA. I'm really impressed with a lot of what the MSAA has been able to do for patients, at least in our region. Things from ranging from cooling vests to getting access for MRI scans, as well as having a number of other patient advocacy supports. And Laura, you can correct me, but I think there are also programs through the MSAA for people who need small grants for home modifications and other services like that.
Actually, they do. I know that MSAA does. We had a patient that could not pay her electric bill and was having financial difficulties, and the MSAA stepped in, paid her electric bill, and, you know, the weather down here is so hot in Texas. So we really appreciated their intervention with that. Cooling accessories is another item that they have for MS patients, and these are free to MS patients. You can go online on the website, contact them. They usually have a little booklet. We do have some of them in the office, you know, of cooling accessories that we could provide for the patient. And I'm pretty sure you do have to fill out a prescription for that, recommending that this patient needs the cooling accessories, and then they do get them free from the MSAA. The other thing the MSAA offers are help with MRIs. Have you used
I've actually used both of those services, and especially the cooling vests. And I'm happy to say that the fashion quality of the cooling vests has improved over time.
Improved,
so
yeah.
It doesn't look like you're wearing a tank anymore. It's like it almost looks like a regular vest, and they're light, and people don't feel self-conscious going out in them. So, yeah, I've used that quite a bit. And, yeah, you just send a cover letter and a prescription, and for patients meeting financial eligibility, it's free.
And as far as the MRI assistance that they have, and these can be patients who have a very large copay or a very large deductible. So it's not totally, for patients who have no insurance at all. And we have the paperwork in our office, which I'm sure you do, which I think you can download actually from the website. And the provider fills out their part, the patient fills out their part with the prescription, and then it's sent in.
You had asked Lori about National MS Society resources, and this would be an interesting one to open up to the group after I comment to see if there's geographic variation in what the National MS Society is able to do for different folks. In our region, there's a program called the MS HomeLinks service, and they provide case management and outreach to help folks who are having financial difficulty, housing issues, significant cognitive issues that may require some additional case management support. Through a referral, substantiating the need for these services, the National MS Society will provide outreach services to those folks. This is a case where those screening tools come into play again.
I can imagine they would. Brant, we have one more question in the queue. I hate to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Go ahead, Doug.
Okay, our first comes from Tony Saladena King from Houston, Texas. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Tony.
Hey again. I was just letting you guys know that the MS Society and the MSAA, they've both been very helpful. The MS Society has provided career coaching for some of our patients who have lost their jobs or had trouble getting and obtaining jobs. So they kind of help, they go through a 13-week process to help them kind of almost like a rehabilitation in a way, so to speak, or they teach them on how, like questions on how to answer so they don't have to disclose that they have MS at the beginning until they're able to get the job. And also scholarships for the different drug companies for patients who are in school or family members. We just had there's a young guy. He probably had MS when he was 8, and they finally diagnosed him at 16 years old, and now his mother has been just diagnosed with MS.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and so.
Could I ask you a follow-up question to your comment?
Sure.
How were you able to advocate, or how did it become established that this career support be offered? Did you approach the National MS Society? Did someone else advocate for this? How is it done? Because it sounds like a vital resource.
No, it's good. If you call your local chapter, we were in transition with social workers, so I was social worker / nurse, and I called our social worker at the MS Society and said, hey, we have a patient. Well, I've had 3 people who have lost their jobs, and I had 3 people who lost their jobs, and how can I help them? And that's when they mentioned the career coaching and that would be helpful to them. And, one lady, and it was also, I guess, like if they have cognitive issues, that's kind of helped them through whatever, or kind of finding out, like you said, assessing if there were some extra supportive needs or something. So.
Those are great resources.
Yeah, so
that's a great idea. I think I'm going to call up the MS Society in our area tomorrow.
And there's a lady, because I was actually in one of our patient programs. I was going to talk about career coaching. I don't know, quite a bit about it, but I thought it might be helpful in maybe getting out there to our patients, and then they would pass it on to their support group. So that way patients wouldn't lose hope that, I'm just going to not have to be able to work.
Absolutely.
Actually, career coaching would make a great topic to talk about on another one of our discussions.
I would say so. And, if I could add in a little research note on that, employment has been identified as a significant predictor of perceived disability. So, providing some kind of some kind of support or education around that, I think would be a wonderful idea.
Well, and if you were going to consider your the screening resources that you talked about today, are there a couple that would just stand out that you would say, let's use this if we were going to help this patient with employment issues?
For employment issues, I would probably recommend the fatigue impact scale, the MSNQ, the cognitive screen, and the self-efficacy scale.
Okay, so those three scales. Okay. Cognition, fatigue, and what was the third?
And self-efficacy. If I could only pick three. You know, I'd love to have the depression screen in there too, but if I could only pick three, those would be the three. Self-efficacy is wonderfully predictive for a number of things, including workplace functioning. So having a self-efficacy score in there is good.
That would be. That sounds excellent. Because the employment issues can be absolutely devastating to the patient and to the family. I did want to mention that for all those who are listening, you will be sent a survey, and it will be concerning the discussion tonight. We would like to have your feedback and your opinion and any ideas that you would like to add. We would appreciate your opinion and your feedback. So those will be emailed out to you, and don't forget, again, to access the website so that you can access Brant's list that he has there. What about, Brant, I have another question.
Sure.
Your U.S. clinical trials listings for new therapeutics, as a resource, what are we going to find when we go to that website?
Sure. Well, you'll find quite a bit, but it's focused entirely on new therapeutics that are in active clinical trials. Any clinical trial that is approved to proceed must be registered with this clinical trials website. So it will give you a great idea of the pipeline of new and emerging therapies and what stage they're at in research, whether in phase 1, 2, 3, or 4.
Well, and this would be a good resource, not just for nurses, but for patients too, correct?
Yeah, although I think that some patients may need assistance in interpreting the clinicaltrials.gov website.
You're probably right. You're probably right.
But I definitely wouldn't bar patients from going there. You just might need to help them understand it.
And then you had a website listed for conversations in MS nursing. That is the www.expertspeakout.com.
Yes, I did. This is something that I actually receive as part of my membership in IOMSN, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I get one of these every 2 or 3 months or so. And the most recent one was Multidisciplinary Team Approach to Comprehensive Care in MS. It can be downloaded from that website that you just listed, the expertspeakout.com. And that one is a great one to start with because for many nurses, they're the people running the clinic. And especially for those new to MS practice or that may be establishing a new clinic, that's a great one to start with. That Conversations in MS Nursing series, I would highly recommend to folks. When I get it as a CD-ROM that I can load into my computer, and it's with audio commentary, and there's slide decks in there that I can follow along with.
Okay. Well, thank you, Brant. We're just about out of time here, Brant. Is there anything you'd like to summarize?
Sure. I guess the one thing I would say is that psychosocial issues are real and they are common and they do make a difference. We focus very heavily on immunotherapy and for a good reason. It makes a big difference in patients' lives. I would argue that psychosocial issues are every bit as important and they can impact treatment adherence, for example. If self-efficacy is low, immunotherapy treatment adherence will decrease. These elements can interact. And especially as nurses, we take a holistic approach to the patient. I would argue that having a psychosocial component to your practice should be a critical component of what you do. And these screening tools could be a great place to start.
Okay, great. Thank you, Brant. This was a great discussion tonight. And on behalf of the IOMSN Town Hall Discussions, I'd like to thank Brant for his presentation. I'd like to thank Biogen, IDEC, for supporting these programs through their unrestricted educational grant, and we appreciate the listeners who have supported the program. Jen Smirka and I hope you'll join us next month. Kathy Costello will be presenting time management for the MS nurse, which I think will be just excellent. So thank you again for joining us for this evening. This concludes tonight's meeting, and I hope you all have a good night. Good night.
Good night.